We've had a big week for political news and a big week to come, so it's a good time to check in with our regular political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome again to both of you.
Thank you.
Now, we should begin with the big news of the week, this memoir by Scott McClellan, the former White House press secretary. He was seen as an ultimate Bush loyalist, and of course his memoir is now highly critical of the Bush administration and many of his colleagues in particular. It had a high shock value here in Washington, actually around the country, but how much do you think we actually learned? You've both had a chance to take a look at the book. I'm going to begin with you, David.
It was a shock value to see him do this, but as for learning, nothing. I mean, I read through not all the book, but a lot of the book, and I think I learned no new facts. I saw no fresh observations. I saw a bunch of cliches. And to me, the problem with the Bush White House was not the spin, which was his charge. The problem was there wasn't a climate of intellectual rigor where people were having big debates. And that's because while 20% of the people in the White House were smart and were capable of having these debates, 80% were people like McClellan, incapable of having these debates. And so they just followed blindly the leadership without really challenging things. And to me, McClellan gets it wrong. He exemplifies what was wrong with the Bush administration, but his diagnosis is not quite the right one.
EJ.
I have a slightly different view than David does. And indeed, McClellan himself is very specific on this point that David made, that the White House didn't have debates. He writes, the White House forestalled any debate about the fundamental goals and long-term plans for the Iraq invasion by pushing so hard on the WMD issue, reduced the larger issue of the future of the Middle East into a short-term emergency, didn't face the hard questions, who would rule Iraq, how would the region respond, how long would the U.S. have to remain on the ground. In other words, I think that this book is important because he is a witness. You know, the White House is coming out and questioning his motivation. They're saying all kinds of bad things about Scott McClellan, but they don't really want to grapple with the core questions he's raising, either about the president or the way the White House made these decisions. I think in terms of sort of something new, at least that I felt was in this book, it's the notion that there is this curious mixture in President Bush of public self-confidence, overconfidence in the eyes of his critics, that may mask a certain kind of insecurity. And that came off at a number of points in the book. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. Now, I was once in an interview with President Bush with a couple other columnists. And one of the columnists there, I think I can disclose this now, is a guy named Max Boot, who was then writing for the Los Angeles Times. And Max knows a lot about military affairs. And he really went at Bush on the troop levels in Iraq and a lot of the post-war planning. And Bush hit him back hard. And they really went at it. And if you had worked for him, you would have been afraid of Bush because he got so hot, his face got red. But in the middle of it, Bush kept saying, I'm enjoying this, Max. I want you to know I'm enjoying this. And you got the sense he liked the fight. But nobody in the White House ever had that fight with him, including the generals, by the way. And so, you know, a lot of it, you'd walk through the White House after these interviews and you'd see people who were smart. You'd see a lot of mopes who were not smart and were incapable of having the debates, even if they had the courage to do so. And I think it was that lack of exchange that Bush would have welcomed if somebody had had the guts to do it.
What does this mean for John McCain, this, you know, look at the White House that brings President Bush back into the spotlight in a very negative way, as John McCain is in the middle of this very delicate balancing act, trying to distance himself from President Bush, but at the same time trying to tap into the Bush money machine, trying to tap into the Bush machinery that got that president elected for two consecutive terms?
McCain has no way to avoid Bush. He has no way essentially to avoid the Republican Party. But you'd have to say so far, at the depths of everything the Republican Party is going through, and it's really in a complete meltdown, McCain is still even in the polls. And when you ask the American people, as Pew did recently, who do you trust to handle Iraq, McCain has a slight advantage over Obama. So the American people, A, do distinguish McCain from a typical Republican, and B, have absorbed apparently what's happened in Iraq over the last 18 months and do give McCain some credit for being for the surge.
And that's why
EJ, EJ's assessment of the Republican Party is shared by many party insiders. You say that this is a party that's in complete meltdown. I mean, some of have likened the party to a plane crashing into a mountain. And yet John McCain continually does very well in these matchups against Senator Obama and Senator Clinton. To what do you attribute that?
Well, first of all, I just want to get to the question about the book. The reason I think this book will come as unfortunate news to John McCain is because it brings us back to the original decision to go into Iraq. How was it made? What were the assumptions? That's the Obama strong suit in this election, that he wants to say to McCain, you may have this experience, but I had the right judgment on the war. I think McCain has built an image over the years of being independent of the party. The real fight here is what is John McCain's first name going to be in this election? Is it going to be John McCain, or is it going to be Bush McCain? And that this history that McCain has has helped him avoid the Bush-McCain label to some degree. And there are questions about Obama's experience that people will have that McCain is trying to play on. The question is, will the meltdown of the Republican Party, is it so profound that no matter how far ahead of the ticket McCain runs, he still loses? And I think that's the question for the year. How deep a problem are the Republicans in?
Now, we don't have a lot of time, but I want to turn to the other big story this weekend, the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee meeting. It's expected to be quite a scene here in Washington. Lots of people, protesters actually, coming in from all over the country. The committee is scheduled to vote on what to do about those delegates from Florida and Michigan. A lot of proposals are actually on the table. I'm interested in hearing from both of you what you think is the likely outcome inside and outside the room. EJ.
Well, I think Obama has the votes. There are 13 Clinton people, 8 Obama people, 7 neutrals. The neutrals, I think, are all going to vote with Obama. So it's up to Barack Obama about what to do. And I think he is going to try to make the most generous offer that he can. You know, the proposal on the table basically is seat Michigan and Florida with half votes. If Hillary Clinton says that's not good enough, I think it's hard under the rules to give her more, but I think Obama's going to try to do that. I think he's going to make it as difficult as possible for her to walk away from the deal because he wants to shut this down. He figures he can get the superdelegates. See, outside, I have no idea how many people are going to show up. There is real anger particularly among women about Hillary Clinton losing the way she was treated in the campaign. So they could rustle up a pretty big crowd.
David. He can sugarcoat it. He can offer her things, but it's defeat. She's going to lose. And I agree with EJ. I think within the room, everything's going to go Obama's way. And the question is, to me, is her, how she accepts the defeat. She's got a group of people who are really militantly for her. She's got her husband who's militantly for her. But is she really going to go on for another couple of weeks? I think if she does not drop out in the next week, then Democratic opinion, which is already impatient, will turn increasingly hostile. And there will be a real sourness.
Is there a question, though, about her supporters also? Because she can appeal the decision made tomorrow.
Right.
And the question is whether her supporters, what's their state of mind? Are they up for this fight?
Yeah, and I would say the sound out of the supporters is enthusiasm for her. And out of the Clinton camp so far is enthusiasm. There's no sign of weakening or looking for that exit strategy so far in the comments that have been made by people on her staff.
I think a lot of Clinton people even don't want this to go all the way to August because that's a recipe for defeat for the party. So that if she really pushed it hard and said, no, I'm not leaving, I think she'd begin to see some defections in her own ranks, even as another part of her camp says no way she should ever leave the race.
And just quickly, is there a star chamber that's sitting on the sidelines that could perhaps shut this down? Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi?
They've already signaled that they want people to make decisions quickly, and that's really saying go with Obama and shut this down. At least that's how I hear it, even though that's not what they're saying.
That's what they want. I don't think they're strong enough to force her.
Good to talk to both of you again. This is EJ Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Have a good weekend.
You too.
At our website, you can read more about why this Saturday's meeting of the Rules and Bylaws Committee is generating so much excitement. That's in the Political Junkie column at npr.org/elections.